nice to come home to. You'd be so nice by the fire while the breeze on high sings a lullaby. You'd be all that I could desire. And the stars chilled by the winter under an August moon burning above. You'd be so nice. You'd be paradise to go home.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome, welcome, welcome to the French Connections Sunday edition. Today's date is June 22nd, 2008. My name is Darryl Bradford Smith. Happy summer to all of you people. Estival, if you will, if you're a French listener. We have a new summer period starting since as of yesterday. And I think last night was the longest day of the year. And today is one of the hottest days here in France. We've topped off with about 80% humidity and about 85 degree temperatures, and I'm sweating. But the news needs to come out, and we need to talk, and I'm up here in my loft. By the end of this file, which I should be about 5 or 6 pounds lighter, I could use it. And, well, we've got some interesting things to talk about. EU Constitution with, of course, my regular guest, Mohamed Rafik. We're going to talk about the financial system, of course, again. Some things I want to start out with here, though. We've been trying to get a lot of people to resurrect some of the old files, and some people have done that. I want to take my hat off to you, Fester, out there for on the Truth Will Set You Free website, reposting the David Pidcock work on the Sabbateans. Now, Mohammed himself is not a stranger to that subject. In fact, he and I did some seminal work, and it wasn't our research, but in fact, we reintroduced it to the world. Anu. And in fact, at the time, few people were discussing the New Bohemians and the Sabbateans and the Jabotinskys and all of these different connections to Carasso and all these other people in the world that so long ago were exposed and then forgotten. And what I'm saying to you is that there's a whole new group of listeners out there who need to understand this conspiracy from its inception. And its latest incarnation here of being a criminal, a gang, has all of these elements that need to be revisited. So go back in the files. We've got old Mohamed Rafik files that don't deal with finance, even though that was his specialty. We've also got David Pidcock. We have Colonel Barry Turner, who will bring up a lot of the British elements and the military elements to it, and so many others that are out there. Even some of the earlier work of Christopher Bolin has had some validity to it. I don't lay any credibility on his latest files or his most recent stuff, but clearly his earlier work, after I vetted it, I looked into it, it was valid as far as I could find out. Now, what's happened to him since then is anybody's guess. I don't know. There seemed to be a sea change in his attitude toward truth-telling around his arrest period. I don't know if that was a way for him to exit the scene, or, in fact, what happened to him is still a mystery. But anyway, that being said, ladies and gentlemen, we are going to talk a little bit here today about this Irish vote that was clearly not in favor of this constitution that they're trying to get passed. Thank goodness for the Czech Republic. The Czech people and the Czech government and the president of the Czech Republic has clearly stated that this needs to be a democratic vote and that the people need to have their word heard and not ignored like they were in France and Belgium. I mean, in Holland. So, Mohamed, are you with me?
I am indeed. Good evening to you, Darryl.
Well, it's great to have you back, Mohamed. You know, I know you're up a little bit on this recent Irish vote, and have you read this recent stuff coming out of the Václav Havel, I think his name is, from the Czech Republic, who says, no, the treaty is absolutely dead because it requires a democratic system to ratify it, and clearly you people are attempting not to do that. Did you read anything about it?
Well, what he's pointing to are the two basic documents that form the legal framework for the, as it's now known, EC, European Community.
Yep.
When we look through the history since the late 60s and early 70s, you know, Dow, we see that this union has gone through lots of different naming conventions.
Mm.
And those names were used to gain the trust and support by people to set them off onto what we're looking at today. And it's clearly been part of a Machiavellian game plan all the way down the line.
Yeah, yeah.
And where people are actually wising up, which is what's going on at the moment, and saying, hey, we don't mind European Economic Union. We don't have a problem with removing internal tariffs and barriers and taxes that may be distorted trade and liberal trade. We're happy for that. We don't necessarily even mind a single currency because it's not that relevant once we've fixed the currency exchange rates between the countries. There's not much in that. But what's gone on is all that's been left well behind under what was originally the Delors Agreement.
That's right. Jacques Delors, in fact. That's right.
Jacques Delors of 1989. Sadly, Darrell, as part of my work on European Monetary Union, I actually have read the Delors Agreement and the 1992 Maastricht.
Painful document, that Delors Agreement, actually.
Rather lengthy.
Yeah.
But all of it was really finance-centric. And what's happened is that back in those days, there was a great deal of publicity within the member states about what was going on and debating with the public what was going on and what the issues were. And since kind of like the euro, because of course the ECU failed in about 94, and the euro came in its place 1999, and it's been there, and as an economic contribution, it's neither been negative nor positive, it's kind of neutral. But what's happened is we've had this group, the statists, as they've been labelled by European political watchers, the statists, are the ones who've actually tried to create a single super state. Now, when we in the UK voted to join into the European experiment, it was then called the common market. Let's join the common market. And the British people were given the opportunity to vote on whether or not to join a common marketplace on the basis of removing all the tariffs and these taxes and these barriers and these tariffs, so that people had an equal opportunity to sell in Europe and make price transparencies, etc. And that all seemed like a good idea, so the British people supported it and voted for it. And there were a few people in the background back then, you know, Dal, who were saying, we believe that this is the first step in a long road to something dark and sinister.
Camel's nose under the tent, Mohammed.
Yeah. Yep. And many people laughed at those people.
Mm-hmm.
As we now know, Ted Heath, who sold everybody on the idea of the common market, at the time he did that, had in his possession documents that said that the medium-term view, i.e. 20 to 30 years, was going to be one of trying to create a single super state.
So what they've used is incrementalism, is what you described in your prior description here. So they've just kind of lulled everybody incrementally into this, into the position we're in today.
Absolutely. But the point is that Ted Heath had documents, and that was exposed by the UK Referendum Party, which we've now managed to enforce on Tony Blair, this idea that the next stage of adopting a new constitution for the country is something that the Prime Minister, that the government, is not actually legally able to enforce. That battle has been won in the UK.
Yeah, but they just tried. Brown tried again to get this this ratification through without having it go to the people, but a court just stopped him. Am I correct?
That's correct, Darrell, because it's already been upheld that the Constitution under the Magna Carta is what's known as entrenched in British law. And I pointed out on a previous show, actually, that one of the prime objectors to the Union of Europe in the form that it was being done behind the scenes was one of the McWhirter brothers. Now, Ross and Norris McWhirter are famous for being the two original compilers for the Guinness Book of Records.
Yeah.
I don't know if many people have come across that, but it's all the tallest man and the shortest woman and the first person to cross the Atlantic and the first person to go to the moon or whatever. All the firsts and the greatest, all the superlatives of existence or known existence are in that book. And one of those two, they were recognised in the UK, you know, Darrell, in their day, as very, very brilliant men, the pair of them. And one of them was actually blown up by the IRA, even though he was never anti-Republican. He had a little bit of pro-UK stance, but wasn't really anti-Republican. But the IRA decided he was a target. And ironically, you know, a guy who did this for a living became a target. We ask why. The answer is that he actually led the legal challenge in the British courts, which stated under the Constitution that the ruling head of this country, of the Crown, the Queen as it is today, is not allowed to be the citizen of any other government or state body. And that under the Magna Carta, that is part of the agreement, that the sovereign will never, ever become a citizen of something else. And actually, post Maastricht, when Margaret Thatcher signed everybody up to Maastricht, the Queen actually herself became an EU citizen.
Yeah, that's right.
But that is illegal under the UK Constitution.
Well, why hasn't it been challenged in it on its face?
Well, this man did challenge it on its face, and he put it in court, and then all of a sudden the IRA decided that he was the greatest enemy to the Republic of Ireland, and they blew him up.
So what you're saying to me is that the whole Irish fight had clandestine roots to the bad guys.
You could certainly pay the IRA to do that kind of dirty work.
Mm.
Somebody clearly did pay them to do that kind of dirty work.
Well, if I see any red-headed crazy men running around my neighborhood here, I'll know where they came from. I'm kidding, guys. I'm kidding, but I mean, the fact is, Mohammed, look, when I looked at the IRA, an interesting subject, when I looked at how much the intelligence services of Britain were working hand in glove with these people, and they were actually carrying out some of the bombings in unison with these people, and knowing full well that British citizens would be killed, there's got to be a lot of red flags raised here about how much infiltration has been done by the British services into the IRA and how much activity they're actually perpetrating against the public and how much of that is actually not true and a scam. And now that's not to say the people at the lower ranks who support the Republican movement weren't genuine, but there are a lot of people at the top of this heap that were very questionable, very, very questionable in my view.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they since the abandonment of the IRA, the new IRA, and I can't believe it's not the IRA, whatever these splinter groups have called themselves, that most of them just went straight into gun and drug running, didn't they, if they couldn't get an official voice. Anyway, coming back to the issue you've raised, Al, you know, various people in Britain did challenge the view that some of these things were unconstitutional, and the general direction was always this idea of incremental change,
yep.
as we know is the modus operandi mm-hmm. of usual suspects, that the Zionists always, you know, if they don't try and do anything overnight because they know the resistance is too great,
yep.
so they like to soft soap it in over a couple of decades or three decades, making the incremental changes. What we now have is that people, as a result of these incremental changes, we've actually hit the crunch point, because these guys have taken it as far as they can incrementally without now telling people they've got to bite the bullet. Now, that's it now. It's, hey, we're now going to sign an EU constitution in everywhere, and you're now going to be ruled from Brussels.
Well, what you need to know about the constitution, listeners, is that when you read it, none of the rules in the constitution are spelled out. What they do in this ridiculous example of tyranny is refer you to addendums and other laws the EU has already passed, is what they do. So you're reading through it, trying to get a grasp of what your rights are and what your responsibilities are as a citizen. And in fact, the whole document is as clear as mud. And you need to spend actually weeks to go and find other prior agreements, the Rome Agreement, what it meant to be Maastricht, and they just make references to your rights through that system. And basically, as you're doing the reading, you're finding out that this whole thing is just bureaucracy and not one iota about your individual rights as a human being. And the things that you would find in Mosaic law or in the American Constitution spelled out for you, Muhammad, in the first to 10 constitutional amendments that we have in the American Constitution. They're non-existent in this one. And what it basically is we're giving over our rights and responsibilities over to a higher power, and that is the state.
It's an irony, Darrell, that these documents that you're referring to, the ancient documents which table a bill of rights for individuals, whether that's the Ten Commandments of Moses, whether it's the Constitution of Medina set out by the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, whether it's the Constitution of America, whether it was the Magna Carta in the UK,
mm-hmm.
all of these things were centric around the rights of people and what they could expect.
Yep.
This document, as you've quite rightly pointed out, the EU Constitution, isn't a Bill of Rights. It's one big, I have to choose my words carefully here, one big pile of documentation of legalese jargon on how they're going to implement laws across Europe.
Yes.
And nothing in it is, you will have the right to free speech. Very simple, plain statements. You have the right to a family. You have the right to religious tolerance. Nothing. Nothing like that at all in this. Nothing.
No.
It's more under subsection 2, paragraph 4, referring back to Maastricht, as per the Treaty of Rome, as per blah, 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 that the state will be allowed to undertake the following acts. And it is not, by any stretch of the imagination, a constitution in the sense of any type of classical constitution that mankind has ever given to people by way of a set of rights.
Well, it seems to me that they've intentionally obscured the meaning of almost everything, because, as I said, Muhammad, when you start reading the documentation within the Constitution, it is always a reference to another work or another treaty, and they don't. They say, Treaty of Rome set out such and such, check Treaty of Rome, and it's just hundreds of pages of innocuous and non-specific bureaucratic controlled tyranny. It's tyranny spelled out in a mishmash language, and it's just a horrendous document in every instance. Now, the Irish recently had a few scholars look at it. They had a few people outside of the bought and paid for assembly that the Irish should be disgusted with look at it and said that this document doesn't rise to the level of a constitution in any sense. It was the same thing the French discovered a couple of years ago. And then what happened, Mohammed, to give everybody a reminder here, when the French public said that this is bad, we don't want it, the Assembly of France ratified it behind the back of their public. But, of course, you know half of the people sitting in the aisles of these of the National Assembly should be arrested for crime or should be outed for pedophilia or should be outed as members of the Grand Orient Lodge working for Kabbalist Zionist Judaism. And the simple fact is they weren't working for the people, and the people's will was not listened to. The same exact thing happened in Holland. The public said no. The Assembly in Holland said yes. The same bought and paid for criminals. And what we're getting is another attempt here in Ireland to pass this to the Irish legislature. But that's not legal in Ireland, is it?
No, it is illegal. And, of course, as I was explaining, Darrell, we've already won the state in the UK, whereby we're allowed to have it as a referendum because it's a change to the constitution. So the government, although they've tried to bring it in through so-called backdoor mechanisms repeatedly, they have in fact failed very often, and now they've permanently failed, and they have to allow the British people to choose whether or not to join a super state. And we, the people of this country, are about 85% to 90% against that. Among some of the crazy things which have happened to our way of life, and you told me earlier in the week, Darrell, that French people are beginning to complain themselves about the way that they're being forced to change.
Well, let's talk about this. The segue to this, where this idea of having competition and a better economic life between states has turned itself into micromanaging people politically, like metering water wells or controlling tagged animals and whether you can slaughter a chicken on your own ranch or on your own farm and eat it on your own dinner table. Or all of these things are now being dictated out of Brussels, and they're saying almost categorically that your way of life and that the things you held dear to your culture don't matter to us. And that, in fact, what we're going to do is social engineer your nation from Brussels. And that's exactly what they've done, isn't it, Mohammed?
Indeed. Well, rather than actually having an ability to celebrate differences and celebrate cultures through the removing of these barriers to trade, which is what we'd all been led to believe, certainly here in the UK, and I would imagine elsewhere in Europe, that what it was going to do was give us the opportunity to buy French cheese more easily, to buy Spanish oranges more easily, and so on. So it was going to give us a greater variety and the ability to vote with our pocket, and as consumers have more say in what we wanted to consume. That was the idea. Of course, among the things that we've been forced to suffer here in the UK is, and I explained some of these to you, Darrell, but many listeners may not be aware of this outside of the UK, we're no longer allowed to sell products in pounds and ounces or in pints and gallons. So when we buy and sell milk in the UK now, it has to be litres. We're not allowed to use pints. And there are people on our market stalls here in my hometown of Croydon in South London, Darrell. We've got one of the oldest continual markets in the UK. The Surrey Street Market has been running for 800 years mm-hmm. in the same spot. And people have been selling produce from Kent, our apples, our cherries, our pears, things that have been grown domestically there, under our domestic weights and measures system for 800 years.
Yep.
And thanks to the bureaucrats in Brussels, there are actual market traders who refused to label in kilos when the law came out because they said, we've got elderly shoppers here who don't know what a kilo is. We've got 70 and 80-year-old women who've been buying in pounds and ounces for the last 70 years, 65 years, whatever, and they understand what they're getting. And so I'm going to maintain my loyalty to that customer base and I'm going to sell them in measurements that they understand. They went to jail for that, Darryl.
They
actually put people in jail. So this is the enforcement level where, rather than celebrating cultures, rather than people coming to the UK and saying, good grief, look at these crazy English people with these strange measurement system, and I don't really know how much of this, that, and the other. And then when the British go abroad and struggle with litres and things everywhere, it was a bit of fun, if you like. But they seem hell-bent on removing these celebratory differences.
Well, what I told you about was the here in France, and you know, this might sound kind of silly to somebody in America listening, but the French are so close to their cheeses. You know, there are over 400 registered different cheeses in France. 400. Many of them are made with raw milk. It's not pasteurized, and the very idea of pasteurizing the milk destroys the quality of the cheese. It's a different cheese. It's not the same thing. And any of you who in America have ever visited France and tried some of the cheeses here would know how important that is. I just had some with my dinner, and I'm here to tell you, raw milk cheese is the only way to eat a good cheese. And the fact is, it's illegal now. Now, the French so far have been ignoring it, and they're in violation of the EU directive to have pasteurized milk cheese only. Now, that might sound like nothing to somebody going to a Safeway and buying the cheeses that Americans eat most of the time, but this just is just one example of hundreds that I can give you about pork and about all. Now, this country is very tied to its culinary history, and it can't be separated from its culture, Muhammad, and yet they're trying to micromanage the French culture out of existence through these laws. It's astonishing that the people haven't risen up sooner to stop this, but yet they sit there. I can't believe how unresponsive the public is to this, but, you know, they're seething under the surface, but there's no revolt. I don't get it.
Well, I, you know, just coming back to the cheese issue, Darryl, of course, we British have been very close to France physically, but also, you know, in terms of allies in wars, etc. And of course, one of the things that British know about French culture is their culinary expertise.
Yep.
Their cheeses are legendary in the UK. You know, French cheese is legendary as to its quality.
Yep.
People who are, you know, connoisseurs of cheese in the UK will always be buying from France. This is why people in America need to understand that basically the French are being told, we want you to put your hundreds of years of expertise on this subject to one side so that you can become subservient to our diktat. Which the whole thing is just, you know, this is real Nazism. You know, people talk about, you know, what these Nazis allegedly behaved like in the Second World War. This is actual Nazism, where as consumers, we're being told you don't have freedom of choice. This isn't free market capitalism.
No.
Not free markets. You don't have, as an entrepreneur, any longer the ability to produce something that you believe people will want to consume. And as a consumer who would like to have that higher quality cheese with that distinctive flavor and taste, I'm now being told that I'm not allowed to buy it either, because somebody who doesn't live in either France or the UK has decided that people in France and the UK are not going to be allowed to consume those products. You can't manufacture and you can't consume it. It's an absolute nonsense.
Well, the other one, you know, Muhammad, here is this. Okay, the French here, they're reeling right now on the rural level, the farmer. Mm. You cannot do anything here. I wanted to put a little building, not very big, to house a couple of chickens and things and some storage. I have to register this stuff. I have to submit it for approval. If I want to put a little stoop that comes off my back stairway out to about the side of my house, they've got aerial photographs being taken of your land, and if you don't file the right paperwork, they hit you with fines. This stuff is madness, and it's all directives out of Brussels.
Of course it's directives out of Brussels. You know, up in Yorkshire, there's a town in the north of England, Darryl, in Yorkshire, Huddersfield, not far from where you're at University of Bradford.
Yeah.
There was a very old local soft drinks company, and that company, called Ben Shaw's, actually, had been making soft drinks in Huddersfield for About 130 years, since the 1870s, Darrell. And what was special about their drinks was that they had a local underground spring that they took their mineral water from to make the drinks. So when you actually drank anything they made, whether it was lemonade or cola, it actually had this really beautiful mountain water as one of its main ingredients. And you could really taste, you know, the drink was special. They've now been forced to stop using that local spring, and they're now making the drinks in another town entirely from tap water. And frankly, Darrell, I wouldn't drink it. I mean, I remember having grown up with one of them and tasted what they're producing now, and I wouldn't drink it if you paid me to drink the difference.
Yeah.
It's that bad. And this is a traditional English business that's been running for more than 130, nearly 140 years, and it's been utterly destroyed by this legislation.
Well, we see it across the board in automotive company regulations, in roadway signs, and adopting new international, Europe-wide standards for this and for that. And the lies that have been told about this union, political union, are incredible. Now, here's a question for you. You have a UK, you have a representative from the UK that supposedly goes to the EU Commission, or I mean, not the EU Commission, to the Brussels EU representative. In other words, everybody supposedly has one. Do you know who yours is?
Well, this is what I was saying the other day, Darrell, about the difference between a delegate and a representative.
Yep.
We in the UK haven't got a clue on the whole who our local person who goes and makes speeches and listens on our behalf is. And what I say is, if you don't know who it is, he can't be representing you.
That's right.
Rather, he's a delegate on behalf of the government.
Well, I don't know who mine is, and I've never received anything from him. I've never found out. I don't even know if that person was elected or appointed or stole the job, paid for it. I don't know what's going on with it. Apparently, there is somebody, because everybody's supposed to have one. But you know something? I'm one of the best informed people that I know in this area, and I know all my local politicians and my local mayors and my local police chiefs, and I know everybody in the regional area, too. I don't know who this person is, and yet their laws and their rules, their regulations are destroying my happiness. My pursuit of happiness is being encumbered by these people. And I think it's time that this is one of the failures that will put a death nail in their plans for world domination, this Zionist cabal. As if the Europeans finally begin to wake up to the criminal acts of this union and finally take a stand against what they've been doing from the beginning. Now, I don't know exactly how they've structured the ECB, although I do know they adhere to the Bank of International Settlements, which, of course, you know, that has its roots right back to the top echelon of the criminal gang. So the fact of the matter is that in some ways they're not divorced from the private ownership requirements. What I'm saying to you, Mohammed, is that this whole thing is tyranny. It smells and looks and reads like tyranny to me.
It is a form of dictatorship where the whole idea of free market principles, whereby a consumer gets to vote with his money, where a consumer can look at the products and services which are available out there and vote with their money, and that a producer can look at the raw materials, where someone is not allowed to use a spring, a natural spring, on their property, but instead become a drain on the national grid of the water supply. Of course, as consumers, we're now paying for the fact that particular soft drink company now has to pay for its water. It no longer has free water as an ingredient. It's now paying metered water. So that, of course, increases the cost of goods, but also the quality has gone down. We lose twofold. We lose in it's not an effective cost model, so where's the economic argument? And what we end up with is an inferior product. So where's the quality argument? It doesn't stand on any basis whatsoever for what people are supposed to be getting. When we look at what they were planning, these Zionists, they said that they wanted to turn these differences amongst the Europeans, they wanted to turn them into a single homogeneous mass. That's their phrase, Darrell, a single homogeneous mass, and to remove any differences and any sense of identity that they have as individuals, and to turn them into just copies of each other. And that seems to me what Brussels is doing in the middle of all of this. And we do have to ask the question, why are Brussels able to make these decisions? I mean, you've seen Brussels. If you're driving at speed and blink, you might miss the place. It's got zero contribution to world history, apart from, well, I can't think of even an apart from.
Well, it was even formed by Napoleon. I mean, Bruxelles Midi, I stopped there on my way, you know. It's on the Falaise line. You can stop there and change trains, and that's about all I'm interested in. Fact of the matter is, it's also the center of pedophilia in Europe. It's the center of the most corrupt area in the country, in the world. In fact, all roads of crimes in Europe seem to lead back to this place.
And of course, there they are, absolutely nothing of a size, making the decisions for all persons in Europe and dictating to the governments. You know, I discovered not that long ago, somebody was doing a critique of Tony Blair and the policies. Now, because the UK government had signed up under Maastricht to agree to implement certain types of changes, apparently what Tony Blair went out and did was make them look like they were his own initiatives.
Yeah, yeah.
And the way in which they've soft-soaped the public into accepting these changes is by getting the different representatives of their countries, and there they are, elected representatives, to pretend that these legal and administrative changes that they're bringing about are actually their own initiatives, rather than something which had been decided in Brussels and sold out. And that in itself was a disgrace, because this means that people don't understand how much change is going on as a result of Brussels. If it had actually had some integrity, which we now know Tony Blair wouldn't know integrity if it walked up and slapped him in the face, if it had some integrity, it would have actually said, well, this is an EC requirement, and that we're implementing the following bit of legislation as part of our compliance. And the reason that they couldn't do that now is very simple. The British public would have realised how many laws were coming in from Europe and how little their own elected representatives were actually deciding and bringing about in our country.
Yep, exactly. Well, but it gets even worse than that for people like myself here, where they try to export this idea of if I identify a criminal as a Zionist following Jew, and now that's not to say all Jews, Muhammad. You know darn well there's a lot of people in the Jewish community are fighting back against these people like we are, and then there are others who have been lied to like the masses of everyone else, and they're doing the bidding unbeknownst to themselves. So the simple fact is, this is not, and I don't have any interest in slamming Jewish people as a group, but rather the criminals that are orchestrating this crime wave. And yet, I'm going to be labeled here. Sarkozy's already talking about shutting people like me down by September with a new internet filtering thing that the rest of Europe wants to sign on to. They've already got two other countries right now saying they think it's a good idea that we get rid of people like me who are trying to tell the truth to the world, and they're going to do it under the claim that I'm an anti-Semite. And of course I'm not. And in fact, these people, for the most part, aren't even Semitic, which is really the biggest laugh of all. They must be sitting in their back offices just with belly laughter going on, saying, "These fools think we're Semites." You know, I mean, Mohammed, it's obscene what I see happening, and I fear very seriously that not only do I risk arrest, but the silencing of this work. Now, of course, you've pointed out that it's very difficult for them to silence this message completely, but they certainly could make it a very encumbered research to find me.
They can I mean, the thing is, you can't censor the internet anyway. This is the first point, Darrell. The nature of the technology means it can't be shut down, and that things can pop up left, right, and centre. You could be fairly sure that those paedophiles that were caught under Operation Orr,
yep,
which hasn't been followed through, are up and running somewhere else at the moment. Possibly a bit more securely, possibly taking lower risks, whatever, possibly taking only cash payments or, you know, maybe some sort of traveller's check payment system or something. But the point is that these guys now will have learned from the previous mistakes and gone out and done it all again. The nature of the technology cannot be stopped. And the laughable thing about Sarkozy coming out and maybe trying to stop things like yourself is that, A, it can't be stopped, but B, why are we wasting so much public money trying to close something like that down?
Yeah.
When we've got so much greater priorities in life that money should be spent on. If really we're just a bunch of loony conspiracy theorists that shouldn't be given the time of day, and we're nowhere near the truth, Darrell, why on earth waste money closing it down? Oh, those guys are a bunch of space cases, especially like the Red type people, they believe in Sasquatch and these abominable snowmen and snakes with legs or whatever going on out there, which is all fantastic stuff. Or maybe it's just a link site, like what really happened. But of course, the French Connection isn't a link site. It does have links on it to news items which are useful. But it is, of course, a research site, and it's got a lot of original materials that you won't find elsewhere. And it was the first one to put different formats up. But if what you're hosting on your site is just nonsense to be ignored, Darrell, then really they should ignore you, shouldn't they?
Well, they should, and especially since the idea that I'm racist in any way or xenophobe is foolish. I've never subscribed to a single act of that kind of thought, and the fact is they don't care. An accusation is as good as a conviction in their minds, and they've proven that. I mean, David Irving, like him or hate him, this guy, right? I mean, I don't particularly. I think he might, in fact, be batting for the other side. But this guy, when they put him in jail in Austria, he said practically nothing to get put in jail. Which makes me wonder, were they just doing that as a show, saying, look, if you talk, you're going to go to jail like David Irving? I don't know if they did that for that reason, or whatever the reason was. But the fact is, recently this guy had to go to court here, a British guy in Germany. You saw this, and he was being forced to bear false witness, and he just said, hey, wait a minute here. You can't compel me to to lie. You can't make that something that I'm compelled to do in any instance. It's immoral, and I refuse to do that. And as a result, he filed a lawsuit saying that I can't be forced to bear false witness in any proceedings of any official type. And he filed suit. Now, whether or not that's ever going to be heard in Germany, because Germany has stated the truth is no defense when it comes to this stuff. All you need is an accusation. Now, the French are taking the German approach to this, where somebody like Darrell Bradford Smith is going to be immediately deemed by the powers on high that I'm a guy that's needs to be eliminated, his voice needs to be eliminated, and so because they think I need to go, I'm guilty. Now, I don't know whatever happened to justice. I don't know whatever happened to anything that's fair in fair play. But Mohammed, this is coming. I smell it. I see it. I see the panic on these people because they're losing the battle of information. So now it looks like they're going to stop playing dirty. I mean, real dirty.
Well, of course, again, this is the other point now, Darrell. That was the second point I was going to raise. They're not just losing the battle of information. They've lost it.
Yep.
They're trying to close the gate after the horse has already bolted. It's just a nonsense. we've gone, as I've explained on the French Connection before now, we've gone as people out there listening, we've gone from, you know, an isolated couple of hundred people in the UK that were fairly well informed to tens of millions worldwide who really understand what's going on. You can turn the taps off now, but it's too late because everybody's already got bottles full of this water. They've already seen it. They already understand it. You're not going to... All you're going to do by trying to close this message down is A, fail technologically to do so, and B, reinforce the point that the message is serious, because why spend money trying to shut down nonsense if this is UFO stuff, if this is Sasquatch stuff, if it's just a bit of racism, then why spend so much money pursuing it?
Well, they've tried, you know, over the years, Muhammad, we've talked, early on, we talked weekly or semi-weekly, and we talk regularly throughout that time. They've done a lot of dastardly things to me, including, I believe, dropped a partner in my lap that was less than forthcoming and honest. And whether or not that happened from mental illness or from intent, it doesn't matter. The fact of the matter is it was an undermining process. You know, it's a difficult slog out here to be a person who puts out, who's a fronter. I front information that is valid. And that's the only crime I've committed, is to tell the truth, Muhammad. And if that's a crime in this modern world, we're all in deep crap. And that's the truth. It is a crime today. So that tells everybody we're in it up to our eyeballs. I mean,
in such time as people vote with their conscience, we were discussing voting with the pocket earlier, Darrell. But now we come to the issue of voting with the conscience. Many people in the world today know what's right and know what's wrong.
Yeah.
They don't act accordingly. And this is a major issue. We've had a little bit of a result that's been very pleasing recently in terms of just the 9/11 issue, I think. You know, getting on the front of the Swiss National Daily, getting on the ABC News of Australia front page. And now even an FT comment, not a third-party comment, but a comment by one of the FT, the Financial Times journalists, who went and attended a 9/11 conspiracy event at a church in the United States, at which the entire congregation was standing up, you know, when the pastor at the front was saying, "We know who really did 9/11, And everybody was standing up saying, "Hallelujah, yes, we do, brother," you know. And he said, "And we know it wasn't Osama bin Laden." And people say, "No way, no way. We know that it was the Zionists and the U.S. government working hand in hand." And they were, "Yes, sir." Now, all that was great, and she actually had to admit in the article, what was interesting about the article, you know, Dal, that she said when it came to WT7, nobody had ever told her about that before, and she had a great deal of difficulty understanding how WT7, she met a demolition expert at this particular convention who explained to her that the building collapsed in its own footprint and it wasn't struck by a plane.
And it fell at free fall speed.
At free fall speed, and he said it's impossible for that not to be controlled demolition.
Well, then you put this Cretan, what's his name, the guy that owned it there, Silverstein, he's saying pull the building, and then of course there's the BBC reporter standing in front of the building itself, building number 7, behind her head, saying building number 7 has collapsed.
Yeah, she went a bit early on the script there.
20 minutes before it collapsed, she's reporting it collapsed already. She screwed up. She got fed a press release early and went on air with it. And there she is reading about a building that had collapsed when it hadn't even gone down yet.
What was interesting was this Financial Times journalist had met some of the people, and this is the point now. She went out on the challenge to meet some of these people, and she realized that there's some serious problems with the official story. The downside, you see, Darrell, in the article, and this is something which the French Connection listeners are aware that you've called to purely, you know, without reservation, is we're not trying to tell people what went on. We just know that what we're being told went on is false and that there should be a proper investigation. The problem is, Darrell, that this journalist was able to start recovering her dizziness halfway in the second half of her article by trying to look at these people claiming that they'd been holograms or that they'd been whatever, whatever, whatever.
Well, that's exactly why they're out there selling this crap about holograms, in order to confuse the story and to add disinformation out there. When can I be honest with you, Mohammed? It doesn't matter if people believe that or they don't. It really is immaterial to the fact that we know whatever the hell happened that day, and there's still details to come out. Whatever happened that day, that what they say happened didn't. What they did report was absolutely proved a lie.
Well, the problem that we have, Darrell, and why you've been trying to tell people, don't put forward your own theory. Just say, hey, I can't be sure. I can give you theories, but I can't be sure what really happened. The reason why we don't want to advocate something is that it's so easy for the professional mainstream to look at the serious evidence, which this woman had done it from the Financial Times, and say, hey, this WT7, that's really super scary stuff, but then tries to rubbish in the second half of her article by saying, yeah, but they believe in holograms, or it was really whatever theories are out there, and there's a million and one theories. We can all theorize. The point is that the theories were used to detract the other key evidence. And this is how the mainstream media has been able to mislead people, because I have friends and family who say, oh, well, I've looked at the 9/11 thing and I can't make my mind up one way or the other. I hear the two sides. No, they don't. They hear one side. They hear the official version, and then they hear the unofficial official version, which is that really it was a hologram that hit the tower. Listen, don't give theories, just stick with the facts. The facts are clear scientific evidence of what happened on that day.
That's right.
One of the things we're being held back from this final step of the way, Darrell, is people advocating theories, because those theories, hey, they weren't there. They weren't actually involved in what happened.
So, but what we do know from first-person accounts is bombs were exploding. This comes from the firemen. We know that there was a security firings weeks before. We know that there was workmen going in throughout the buildings. We know that there were Israelis dancing and filming, saying that they were sent there to document the event. Now, how the hell would they know that they needed to document the event in advance?
There were text messages sent out in advance.
Odigo messaging. We know that they were on the flight manifest of the so-called terrorists. They weren't even on the bloody planes. They didn't make it onto the flight list. Well, ask yourself this simple question, ladies and gentlemen. Can you get on an airplane without your name being on the list? Give me a break. And pristine, perfect condition passports floating down into lower Manhattan to be found. And, I mean, come on, there's 1,001 facts that can come out that make you want to vomit. And then watch the movie 9/11 Mysteries, and take a picture, take a look, and use your mental picture of what it is to cut a beam in half with a charge. And then listen to the man in that same film say how they cut major beams in half with these charges, and he shows you a picture of one that they cut. They're not similar. They're identical. They're identical. And the fact is that these beams will blow 500, 600, and 700 meters from the center of the blast. It's astonishing, Mohammed. The factual part of this alone, who cares about a theory?
Exactly. If we just stick to those facts, when the mainstream journalists come along, we will win over, because that woman wouldn't have a second half to her article. It would have finished with the whole WT7 collapsing in its own footprint, in free fall, demolition expert at the present saying this. And she wouldn't have anywhere to go. She wouldn't...